Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:50 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is September 8th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, I think I'd like to just kick off initially with a little bit of housekeeping, and we're still working through a couple of the kinks in the Substack email system. So I will, I think I've figured out how to send out independent free newsletters and then also the full version for subscribers. I think the big difference between the way that we've classically written our newsletter is that it is different to how everyone else seems to do it. Everyone else picks one thing to write about and only writes about that, and then gives away the first part, and the meat is in the rest of it, which basically then incentivizes the writer to come up with a hook in the first half of the article and then try to get people to subscribe in the second half. What it facilitates then, or I guess what it encourages, is more of a marketing copy way of writing the free content. And that's not something that either David or I have ever really done with our free content. But what I will start doing is just sending them out independently. And what I will also do, as because I've started paying attention to some of the feedback I've had about the video and the audio, and I'm putting a preamble into the beginning now, and that is going to go out as a free part of the podcast, which I'm also now posting independently on Substack. So not only is the comment of the day, the video and the audio, being posted in the subscribers area, but then there is an independent posting of the audio content in the podcast section. So that's available for anyone who wants to listen to it on the Substack app. Of course, for paying subscribers, that is. Now, when we think about what's the main meat of today's broadcast, what I'd like to think about is the basis of discussion on the first day of the chart seminar, which is that there's really only two topics. There are money flows, and there is the consistency of charts. And when money is available, it's a lot easier to make some in the markets. When money is less available, it's more difficult. And we've had perfect examples of that over the last couple of years. Well, then of course, where you have consistent trends, there are good reasons for it. When you have high commonality and you have many instruments within a given sector that are performing, well, then it gives you a clue to where the secular trend is. So I think that's going to be the basis for what we'll talk about today. And of course, the whole question of how much money there is out there is, I think, going to be progressively more important as it declines. And now, I created this chart of the central bank total assets for the largest economies back in 2012. And back then, 10 trillion sounded like a lot of money. But it got up to a peak in 2022 of 23 trillion. So, over the course of a decade, the total assets on central bank balance sheets doubled. Now, there were two particular trends that helped that to occur. The first is the willingness of central banks to print more money, and then the second is the weakness of the dollar. So, over the course of the last year, we've had a good-sized rebound in the dollar, which has resulted in the size of central bank balance sheets contracting, outside of the USA, that is. And then, of course, we've had the trend of quantitative tightening, and several central banks have been engaged in that, but most particularly the Federal Reserve, and actually the ECB, the Bank of Switzerland, and the Bank of England as well. The big outliers have been Japan and China, but of course China didn't engage in the same volume of money creation during the pandemic that some of those other countries did. So it doesn't have the same kind of inflation issue right now that they do. But we are back in a rather interesting area, because this measure has never moved below the 1,000-day moving average. So that's a big question. And I think that is going to be the big question of the, I guess, really the next year, whether we see a sustained move below this level or whether it bounces. Now, I thought this was an interesting chart today. So when we just look at the G4 central bank balance sheets and we look at the 12-month rate of change, so we can see that there was obviously a clear peak back in 2020. But now the rate of change is slowing down and in fact may be starting to turn around. And obviously this is and going to go a little way towards answering this question. Are we going to see greater availability of cash from central banks as we see the total assets coming back down into the region of the 1,000-day moving average? Now, I don't think that this is a measure that they're particularly looking at, but we can obviously look at what's happening out there in the wider world, where we know that interest rates have gone up materially. But before we look at some of those interest rate or bond charts, it's also worth considering that back in 2012, the vast majority of new money that was being created was as a result of central bank activity and the willingness, particularly of the Federal Reserve, to engage in quantitative easing, then for the ECB to do the same thing, then for the Bank of Japan to do the same thing. That resulted in significant asset price appreciation. But the bang for the buck continues to deteriorate. It requires successively larger rounds of additional new stimulus in order to have the same effect. So we saw the biggest yet during the pandemic, and of course, if this sequence is going to be sustained, then we should anticipate that or at least the logical assumption would be that if we see central banks providing assistance again, then it will be a larger infusion than what we saw during the pandemic. Now, obviously, that would be in response to a significant problem, but the reality is that investors are willing to bet that we're still in this environment and that we can rely on central banks to continue to print with enthusiasm when we see a problem evolve. But of course, then during the pandemic, we have the additional question coming out. And I created this additional chart to think about that back in 2019, because I was wondering back then what was the outlook for government deficits? Not simply because of the Trump tax cuts, but because lots of countries were starting to think about what this was going to look like. And they were exhibiting a great deal of enthusiasm for spending money they don't have. And I think the most important caveat with this particular chart is that not every country reports their deficit at the same time, so it does tend to be choppy. But I think the most clear defining characteristic evident here is simply that it ranges for a long time, and then when it breaks out, it didn't go back down again after 2008. And after breaking out in 2019, and really in 2018, so that was as a direct response to the Trump tax cuts, then it has not subsequently gone back down again. And we're currently sitting on a deficit of about 1.8 trillion. So, when we think about where the money is coming from in order to sustain the bull market that has been underway now for the last couple of years, despite the fact that central banks have been contracting the size of their balance sheets raising interest rates, reducing the money supply. The fact that governments have been willing to run these enormous deficits has been the primary factor in driving money into the stock market. And while the central bank chart is coming back into an area of support, there doesn't seem to be any real movement on the deficit question. Governments are still not really doing much, but most particularly the USA is not doing much to address the deficit. And it could be upwards of $2 trillion next year. So that alone is something that is also going to represent a significant fiscal stimulus. And I think when we think then about this argument about whether we should have a soft or a hard landing, well, I think investors are willing to bet that there will be a soft landing, not because the Federal Reserve will or not or will not do its job, but rather that the U.S. government is going to be more than willing to supply additional fiscal stimulus, and that they will simply print the money and send it out to whoever needs it. And I think investors also took some heart from the fact that back in March, when there was some issues with the regional banks, then they just stepped in and said that they would guarantee, or the Federal Reserve stepped in, I guess, and said that they would guarantee all deposits everywhere. So that certainly lent some support to the view that there will be additional assistance measures provided. Now, when we think then about where are we in this broader cycle overall, I think that it is important to just be cognizant of the fact that the yield curve is inverted, and that sooner or later it will become de-inverted. And usually, and I think historically, this is where we have the reliability of this indicator as a lead indicator for recessions. It's when it becomes, when it moves back to a positive slope and moves back above the zero bound, that's generally the red light warning that we're going to be heading into a recession and that there will be a meaningful pullback in the stock market. And because bond yields have gone up, and because earnings haven't been keeping pace, we've just gone through the second quarter, and we have not had a big move higher in earnings, despite the fact that analyst estimates are that there will be continued improvements in earnings for the S&P 500. What we have at the present moment is that the S&P 500 earnings yield is less than that on the three-month yield. And this is a very significant part of the way that institutional investors are looking at the stock market. Because if they can get more by taking no risk and putting their money in short-dated bonds, then why take the risk in the stock market? So the three-month yield continues to push higher. And it's up now to 5.4%. So this trend higher remains very much intact. And this isn't something that's going to turn around until the Federal Reserve eventually starts to at least give a clear signal that they're pausing, and most particularly when they start to cut rates. But they're not under any clear duress to do that right now. And I think one of the primary reasons why they're less likely to raise to cut rates imminently is because core services remains really quite firm. So core services, less housing, is one of the more important charts out there at present, because we have the very clear long-term trend where it never really pushed above 4% from 1993 until 2021. And since 2021, it hasn't come back down below 4%. And in the aftermath of the global financial crisis in 2008, It popped on the upside, but then the median value was around 2%, plus or minus 1%. So now we're at a very different environment overall. And I think what everyone is cognizant of is the last time we saw a breakout like this, where we had relatively depressed inflation, which then subsequently jumped higher, was from the middle of the 1960s. And everybody remembers the inflation of the 1970s, but they don't pay much attention to the fact that inflation was ramping higher in the 1960s, and it was subsequently the oil exporters rebelling at the devaluation of the currency, and then subsequently at the USA's willingness to support Israel that resulted in the oil embargo. But it was the big move higher in inflation in the 1960s that resulted in countries wanting their gold back, and then the gold window was closed by Nixon in the early 1970s in response to that. Now, that effort was aimed at trying to get inflation under control, and it worked temporarily. And then subsequently, inflation popped back straight back up on the upside. So we're at an interesting juncture here, because when we think about the ability of the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates and their ability to greatly increase the size of the balance sheet, or for other countries to do the same thing, well, in order to do that, they really do need to have inflation back under control, because the risk is that you move into a similar situation to what we had in the 1970s. And if they do increase the size of their balance sheets without getting inflation under control, well, then we really are going to have a much worse inflation problem later. And I think that is the big question that markets have not yet really had an answer for. In order to get that core services down, well, then we need to see that some of those core services endure some duress. So what are core services? Well, healthcare is a big one, and then also education is another one. And then insurance is another one. One thing that is interesting is that the education sector doesn't ever seem to cut their fees. My eldest daughter is in senior year now, and her inbox is being inundated with emails from various colleges. But one thing is certain is that none of them are cutting their fees. Then the S&P 500 insurance sector is right in the region of its peak. So this, I think, is incredible outperformance relative to the broader financial sector, which has been under quite a lot of duress. So that would suggest that they are both roughly insulated from the current bout of monetary tightening, and also that they do benefit from higher interest rates overall. But the banking sector is trending downwards and was a little steadier today, but has clearly now encountered resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And it's not just the big banks, it's also the smaller banks. And the regional banks has also encountered resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So these are indications that monetary conditions are tightening, and that it is primarily the willingness of the US government to run these enormous deficits that is helping the broader market to hold up. So the Nasdaq index is right in the region of its peaks from back in 2021, and it has had eight companies that have generated the vast majority of returns over that time period. So when we look at the Fangman companies, and Netflix is still a part of this, despite the fact that it has been dropped from other measures, well, then it looks exactly like the NASDAQ overall, and does look to be encountering resistance around the 12 trillion level. The biggest company in the world is Apple, and it looks like it has put in a lower high, having broken out to new all-time highs. We now have a failed upside break, and the dynamic of the failure is larger than the dynamic of the breakout. Then it subsequently bounced from the region of the 200-day moving average and then came down with a bang again in here this week. Then it got up to test to the 180 level in here today and wasn't very happy up there. So there's clearly the potential that we're going to see additional downside. This is not just about Huawei. Excuse me, I'm just going to cough. I apologize. So this is not just about Huawei and the fact that what phone you use in China is becoming a token of nationalism. It's also the simple fact that the iPhone has embedded redundancy and that the batteries only charge about 1,000 times, which means that about every 3 years people have to replace their phone, or at least replace the battery, but the vast majority of people replace the phone. So considering the fact that most people bought a new phone in 2021, then we're probably not going to see a big jump in new orders until 2024. And that would suggest that between now and then, there's ample potential for the share to pull back into the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, I know myself, I'm probably not going to buy. I don't particularly like Apple. And I get annoyed by all of the ads that I get or pop-ups on my phone telling me that I need to buy more iCloud space when I don't like using iCloud. And I'm certainly not going to pay for any of the other services that they have. And I haven't seen a show on Apple TV that I'm particularly interested in. But nonetheless, I will continue to buy the phone because all the apps that I have are probably on it, and that it's just a pain to go off and do the same thing again. So I'll buy another phone, and I think most people are in the same boat, and the vast majority of young people would rather have an Apple product than anything else. So I don't think that Apple is going to come back down below the 1,000-day moving average, but I think that it is more than likely going to get there. And that would be a meaningful pullback in terms of the price action. But in order for me to be correct, it's going to have to sustain a move down through that 200-day moving average. Now, Apple, being such a large company, needs a lot of things to go right. And I think this is one of the more important points that we have, that when you have mega cap companies that have done spectacularly well, and they truly are autonomies. And that was the way that we started thinking about shares and companies back in the early 2010s, that there were large companies that were ideally positioned to benefit from the rise of the global consumer, that they had the financial heft and were truly globally oriented, that they could benefit from the global economy. They could benefit from the rise of markets outside of their own. They had the wherewithal to base their operations in the most attractive locations, and they had free access to every market that they wished to sell into. And as a result, they were like mobile principalities. And that was the basis for all the shares that I listed in Crowd Money. And it was also the basis for the Autonomies Fund. But the reality is now that some of those factors are going to become more questionable. So the primary bull market trends that evolved from approximately 2012 onwards were the rise of the global consumer and improving living standards and rising hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people out of poverty and into the middle classes. And that trend continues. It's just not happening in the same countries at the same times now as it was then. So that trend is still in place. But access to markets is bifurcating. And you have certainly got less Chinese imports by the USA, but they are increasing imports from other countries. So I thought this was an interesting chart as well, that for the first time since 2003, the USA is now importing more from Mexico than it is from China. And China's share of imports has fallen from about 21% down to less than 15%, and the trend is still going downwards. So that's certainly evidence of the less about deglobalization. But I think it would be more correct to say that supply chains have altered and that manufacturing will take place in different countries, that there will not be a 100% reliance on China. And the nice thing about manufacturing in China is that you can get rapid prototyping done in the morning and you can start production in the afternoon. That you can go to Shenzhen, Guangdong, province generally, or anywhere around Zhejiang. And if you have a product idea, the chances are that you can find a factory that can produce the prototype and they will be located close to where it can be manufactured. And all of the components for whatever product you want will have been manufactured within a 30 or 50 mile radius. And that's certainly something that is very attractive from the perspective of countries. But what we are starting to see now is very similar to what happens with the biotech sector. The biotech sector generally tends to thrive around clusters or hubs. And this was something that I discussed with David Brown, and he wrote a very interesting paper for the EU on how to develop biotech clusters. But I think the same logic is going to be used in terms of developing manufacturing clusters. And obviously, the manufacturing cluster in Guangdong is independent in many respects from the manufacturing cluster in Zhejiang. And then there's another manufacturing cluster in Qingdao, and they don't generally produce the same things. But what you definitely have for a manufacturing cluster is a focus of expertise on a given product suite. And we're definitely getting that kind of clustering of expertise in Vietnam. And the Vietnam index is now bouncing from the region of the 200-day moving average. And this was a new recovery high in here this week. But perhaps the more important point is it has broken the downtrend. And Vietnam has a manufacturing cluster. So they have some electronics, they have some solar panel manufacturing, and of course they have a lot of wood product manufacturing, and then they have garment manufacturing. So that's certainly where some of their strengths are. And then you have the fact that VinFast has just been released. Now, the company may not survive, and I think the release of the share is probably more of a gimmick than anything else, but what it very successfully did was to highlight that Vietnam is on the map in terms of manufacturing electric vehicles. So that is an example of how a manufacturing cluster has been created. And of course, we have lots of examples of manufacturing clusters around the world. but particularly, for example, Germany. And Germany has done what's necessary to ensure that its manufacturing has been sustained, which has been to embrace automation. Japan and South Korea and Israel have done the same thing. They've adopted automation. They've focused on R&D and maintaining their competitive advantage. And that has helped to sustain their economies. And I don't think there's any reason to believe that that's going to change. And rather, they could potentially benefit from a reshoring from China. And the KOSPI index is hovering in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, I think that there are significant risks for South Korea because of the use of its components and the fact that it is exceptionally close to China. They don't have much of, they don't have a lot of leeway in terms of whether they're going to have manufacturing capacity in China, whether they're going to aid the Chinese government in pursuing their technology ambitions, because not only do they have the rumbling disquiet with a nuclear-armed neighbor in North Korea, but they already have a lot of manufacturing capacity inside China. So this moving of manufacturing capacity is going to have to be exceptionally delicate. And what will probably eventually occur is that companies will have their Chinese manufacturing for the Chinese market inside China, and that manufacturing for everywhere else will take place somewhere else. And of course, with the G20 right now in India, then India is obviously trying to hold itself out as a major destination for foreign flow. The Nifty index is popping on the upside in here this week. One thing that I think anyone who's looking at political debates right now or looking at major TV political events will obviously recognize that there are a lot of people of South Asian descent are in very senior political positions. So you have the Prime Minister of the UK, you have the Mayor of London, you have the First Minister of Scotland, and then you have two Republican candidates of Indian descent running against Trump for the Republican nomination. Now they may not win, but they're certainly putting their names on the ticket. And I think this is also a great example of the ingenuity and the ambition of the native Indian population. That, on the one hand, we might argue that the diaspora is effectively a brain drain, and that India has historically sent its best people abroad, and its most ambitious people, when they go abroad, have tended to be exceptionally successful. And then Indian people just happen to end up in positions of power because of that ambition, but also probably because they come from relatively high castes and assume their position is ordained. But there's no question that this ambitious and no, I guess, can-do attitude is something that India is very clearly helping to or trying to imbibe in the domestic population. And of course, India is has the, I guess, has the very clear advantage that they have a large young population, that they're in a geopolitically important position in the world, and that they have the clear reliance of the rest of the world to provide manufacturing capacity for them if China is less reliable. So India is certainly a major contender for a significant advance over the medium and long term. Now, there is absolutely no question that there will be occasions when the Indian market is perforated by a big decline. It is still an emerging market, and we do need to be cognizant of the need for governance to continue to improve. And there will be times when it will pull back by 30 or maybe even 40%. And those will be the times where you will get generational buying opportunities. But nonetheless, it is trending higher in a consistent manner at present, and there's no reason to conclude that it's not going to continue to do that. Now, as we think about what were the big trends that drove the market higher in the early 2010s, the first was the rise of the global consumer and the breakouts on those very big global companies. But then you also had the fact that technological innovation was taking off, and that a lot of the promises that were made in the big TMT bull market of the 1990s were actually coming to fruition, most particularly the internet and 4G, and that created the app society. And I don't think that's ever going to change, that we're going to be in this app society forever, that people will continue to use their phones and their personal access to the internet to help them and to entertain them for the lengthy medium term, and that trend will continue in the emerging markets, and it will also allow particularly Africa, but also Asia, to skip very significant steps on the way to development. One of the reasons why Japan was able to progress in this in the way that it did in the aftermath of the Second World War is that they started with a blank slate, and they had to adopt better governance because they had limited resources. They had to really to embrace technological innovation in order to build up a competitive advantage. And that laid the groundwork then for the big bull market, and it peaked, and I guess it accelerated into a bubble because of the use of leverage. One of the things that China has done is mirror that trajectory, and then over the last decade has embraced leverage in the same way that Japan had done. But that starting with a blank slate and embracing technology is something that lots of emerging markets are doing now, with the rollout of internet access through phones, through the rollout of fast connectivity. That is something that is helping to drive growth in India. It's also something that's helping to drive growth in places like Ethiopia and Nigeria. Now, they are way further down on ter in terms of the steps of economic development, and governance is still wanting, but they have exceptionally large young populations, and they will also become manufacturing centers. And of course, then you have countries like Mexico. So the Mexican index has been sustained by the strength of the peso over the course of last year, and it's now rolling over. And the dollar has been resurgent over the course of the last couple of weeks. So this was the initial period of outperformance by Mexico, where we had investors beginning to move there and thinking about where to invest, how to invest, and what to buy. And just a simple act of buying the currency was enough to support the market. But now the dollar is rebounding. Inflationary pressures in Mexico are coming down very quickly. That's going to reduce the interest rate differential and will allow the Mexican Central Bank to reduce rates. Same thing is happening in Brazil. They raised rates aggressively. They got inflation under control, and now they have the wherewithal to start cutting rates and to support their economies. I think that is about as clear a template as we might wish for what we can expect from other countries. But because they didn't raise rates as quickly as those as either Mexico or Brazil or Chile for that matter, then they're not going to see inflation coming down as quickly. That basically means that rates will have to stay higher for longer. Now, the reality is that we've definitely seen an uptick in factory manufacturing, so building factories in both the USA and in Mexico. And a lot of the investment or foreign direct investment that's been moving into Mexico has gone into utilities. So there's still a little bit of reticence, and I think there's still going to be a time lag between when investors want to invest in Mexico, but then we'll need to wait until those factories are built before they start to really see the results of it. And then, of course, the makeup of the market is going to be, we're not going to see the listing of manufacturing capacity in the stock market. What we would be relying on is increasing domestic demand growth and rising standards of living that would drive the stock market higher. So from my perspective, I've been waiting for a pullback because I didn't think that we're quite there yet. And I do think that it is likely that the iShares Mexico ETF is going to revert back down towards the 1,000-day moving average and provide an attractive entry opportunity. It has clearly broken the uptrend over the last week. So we're definitely looking at a period of time where there's going to be a reorientation of domestic supply chains. And technological innovation is going to fuel economic growth in the emerging markets. Now, the third and final big trend beginning in the early 2010s was the evolution of unconventional supply and the shale revolution in the USA. And that resulted in natural gas prices collapsing and staying down. And that's still the case in the USA, at least. And oil prices failing to sustain moves up out of this long-term range. But oil prices are rallying right now, and they have clearly broken the downtrend. So it does raise an important question. Are we now in a new bull market environment? And I don't think it's enough to say that we have a breakout now and that there's potential for additional upside. There's no question there. There's clearly the potential that oil prices are going to move back up to the upper side of the range, and that would bring prices above the $120 level. When I think about whether we're going to have a big bull market, what I'm thinking about is it going to exceed $140 and rally to $200 or $250? That's where I think the big bull market argument has to center. So what do we need for a secular bull market? We need supply and elasticity. We need rising demand. If we're talking about anything other than a commodity bull market, then it's going to be similar. When you have technology, technology is about doing more with less and developing something that instantly creates productivity growth. And when that occurs, then value is created out of nothing. And then it is basically a siphoning of resources out of the industries that are going to be displaced. But when we think about the energy sector, the argument that is currently being used as a bear case is that energy is no longer about extraction, it's about technology. And we don't need to dig coal, we don't need to pump oil or gas, because what we can do is come up with something that is technologically based, like wind or solar or geothermal or hydrogen. And they don't depend on access to anything in the ground, or there's no limited supply. And all we need is capital and the will, and we will no longer have any reliance on energy from fossil fuels. So what we've seen over the course of the last year or two is just how interest rate sensitive some of those technological solutions for energy are. They're incredibly capital intensive, and energy historically has been a very capital intensive sector. The reason why investors would put the capital to work is because, one, you know it works, but then two, is that you have security in terms of your customers. There is no alternative. So we're in an interesting situation right now because with the evolution of renewable energy, then there is competition in terms of the customer. And that increases the risk premium and also increases the risk of a capital infusion for building new infrastructure not being fruitful. And this is where the bull case for energy now comes in, because there hasn't been a lot of investment in new supply, because investors don't want to fund the building of a new refinery, and they don't want to put money into the ground for drilling programs when they don't know what the price is going to be in future. And then because of the fear around the changing climate, then university endowments will not put money up. And I've spoken with private bankers that focus on just raising cash for drilling programs. And they basically said 2 years ago that the money from university endowments just evaporated, and that it was very hard now to raise institutional money. And of course, what that also leaves the market open to is private credit. And the rise of the private debt markets has been a very significant trend over the last 15 years, that the introduction of very austere regulations on the banking sector and the clear effort to ensure that the global financial crisis never happens again. And certainly the answer there was to ensure that banks won't be allowed to take on the same kind of risks that they have in the past. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a risk appetite. It's simply that it is now private companies, and most particularly private equity companies, are producing that kind of risk product. And they are also moving into the energy sector, the natural gas sector, and the coal sector. Now, because there hasn't been a lot of active listed companies engaging in additional new supply, then with a continued upward trend in global demand, then we have this supply inelasticity environment. But it's also worth considering that China's consumption of oil appears to have peaked. And Sinopec basically came out with that data this week. So that's something that's going to limit the potential for additional upside. If China's demand growth has peaked, then demand growth from the rest of the world is going to have to rise faster. Now, of course, with the reshoring, or I guess it is the alternative shoring trend, then energy demand growth in other countries will increase as well. But it's going to be a long time before the living standards in much of the emerging markets reach those of China today. So in the short term, and I think that is over the next 6 to 9 months, we could easily see oil prices continuing to trend higher. And of course, that is going to take a lump out of living standards. And it's the two things that generally tend to create recessionary problems is surging oil prices or tighter monetary conditions. Well, we have tighter monetary conditions, and now we're starting to see surging oil prices. So that basically increases the potential that we're going to have a recession. And of course, that's also what the total assets of central banks chart that we looked at right at the beginning of this broadcast tells us, that we should be anticipating that there's going to be an additional capital infusion, but it won't happen until there's a problem. And that problem is starting to coalesce because oil prices are moving higher, and the daily average gasoline price is popping on the upside. It's up now to $3.80. So that's about as high as it gets. Now, obviously, it was higher in 2022, but we're definitely at levels that we saw back in 2008 or in 2011 through 13. And then US natural gas prices are still locked in a long base formation, and there's no evidence really that supply is in any way restricted. But the fact is that we still have a global trend of worker disquiet, and this is also very reminiscent of what we saw in the late 1960s, that people demand better standards of living, and they are definitely asking for more money. And we're seeing that in the Chevron workers at the Australian LNG facility. So that could potentially put upward pressure on natural gas prices in the short term. Eventually, that industrial dispute will be resolved and supply will increase. Now, when we look at the Dutch natural gas price, it's not moving. So they have ample supply for the beginning of the winter, and prices are still holding here above the long-term range. And of course, this is why charts are so important, because we can see that before the invasion of Ukraine, prices really didn't go above 28, and now they're at 50. And obviously, the incredible spike we saw last year was because of price insensitive buying. And now that some mitigation solutions are in place, well, natural gas is back at a higher base formation or a higher step. And it would require a material change in the energy outlook for Europe to bring natural gas prices significantly below the 50 level. We are also, I think, looking at slower growth because the carbon emissions price has weakened. And this is government supported. So every time it weakens, it does tend to bounce. But it is weakening right now, and if this were any other chart, it would look like a top formation. What it implies is that demand for energy in Europe is less than the continued strength in the oil price would suggest. And that would, I think, point towards less demand. Now, what I find especially interesting at present is that the DAX index is really very steady. Now, if we look at the long-term chart for Europe, well, then we have this exceptionally long range, and then it broke out in 2021, and it has been consolidating. Now, that's at the Europe index, Europe 600. So that includes the UK and many of the Nordic countries and Switzerland. But this looks like a big first step above this very long-term base formation. Now, we should also then look at the TOPIX index in Japan, because it also has this exceptionally lengthy base formation, and then a very small, in hindsight, pause and a first step. And subsequently, it has broken on the upside. So this is very clear evidence of renewed enthusiasm. Then we haven't, what I think is rather interesting is that in nominal terms, we have Europe has broken out and we have Japan that has broken out and India is doing very well. But the US is still preeminent and the US dollar has been very steady and it has rebounded over the last couple of weeks and it has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. So we're seeing oil prices moving higher and the dollar is moving higher. And these are going to limit the availability of liquidity. So we are more than likely going to have a period of underperformance. A U.S. recession is looking more likely than not. Canada has had one negative quarter of economic contraction. Germany has been flirting with a recession for a while. And then, of course, we have the big conundrum of China. And while a U.S. recession is likely as a result of all the tightening, the continued underperformance that we have in China is very material. And I think we can just simply look at the chart action. The stock market has not been a great place to try and make money in China for really quite a long time. And it's now trending downwards. But the place where money has been rewarded has been in the Chinese bond markets. And bond yields are now jumping higher. So they got all the way down to test the lows from 2020 around the 2.5% level. And are up 16 basis points over the last 3 weeks. And it has now broken the downtrend for this year. And then the renminbi is breaking on the downside. So when we think then about what are the challenges, China embraced leverage in much the same way that Japan did. And now they have some of the most expensive property in the world relative to domestic incomes. And of course, they don't allow foreign investors to buy their property. So that basically means they have the most expensive property in the world that people in China can potentially afford. And when you have a price to income ratio that is over 30, then you're talking about people saving their entire income for their entire lives and only in their old age being able to afford a house. So these are very significant issues, and there is a social component to that. And potentially China is now attempting to prick that bubble because total debt in the economy has jumped from 17 to 51 trillion in the last 10 years. And that's an exceptionally large volume of leverage. If China does not provide the assistance required, does not issue additional funding to try and mitigate the downside risks, then we're going to have a difficult period of time where the Chinese economy could underperform by a significant margin. That would export deflation around the world. It would allow interest rates to come back down. It would have a material impact on commodity demand. That is the primary reason why I am less than convinced that we're going to have a big new commodity bull market. I just don't think that the technology solution is ready on the renewable energy front. The big limiting factor is batteries. Batteries are too expensive and don't last long enough, don't have the energy density necessary to supplement gasoline. So that's a significant issue. It's a technology bottleneck that could potentially be solved by the end of this decade. I do think that when we think about a technological solution that is not especially influenced by availability of a basic resource, then The nuclear sector is ticking a lot of boxes, and the uranium ETF has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. The potential for the rollout of Generation 4 reactors, which have or many of those designs have anti-proliferation attributes, is a very significant factor. It's going to potentially provide us with a new energy revolution. And in many respects, the intensity of energy used in the economy is a provider of productivity growth. And lower energy costs contribute to people being able to do more. And we need those kinds of solutions. So I think that in the short term, we have the risk of recessions. Over the medium term, deflationary forces are more likely to take effect if China rolls over. I think central banks have probably been chastened by the scare from inflation, and they have full cognizance of what happened in the 1970s. To me, that suggests that we're going to have shorter, sharper cycles because they will provide assistance when there's a problem. But we've seen twice already in the last year that central banks have withdrawn that liquidity quite quickly after the problem has arisen. And that suggests that we're not going to have these long periods of time where money is left in the system and interest rates stay down indefinitely because of that risk of inflation. And now that the inflation genie is out of the bottle and that workers are increasingly demanding higher wages, then this isn't something that central banks can treat as a trivial act. So what happens over the course of the next year is going to be very heavily dependent on what happens with China. What happens in terms of the beginning of the repayment of student loans in the USA, the running down of personal savings in the USA, and then subsequently what happens in terms of the war in Ukraine. And that is a very significant uncertainty as well. Russia's budget went back into a surplus today. So they are well able to persist in this war and potentially indefinitely. And it's really now a question of which country grouping has more manufacturing capacity for armaments. And we have Ukraine going to South Korea and sourcing armaments, and you have Russia going to North Korea and sourcing armaments. So we are going to be in a more geopolitically intense environment, regardless of what happens. And China's deleveraging process is something that could have a material impact on the commodity sector. So I just don't think that we are quite there in terms of thinking about a new big secular bull market in commodities. And copper prices look like they have room to fall from here. Now, of course, lower commodity prices would certainly improve the economics of some of those renewable energy products. But of course, if we have less demand for commodities, it's generally as a result of lower economic growth, and then will people have quite the same demand for those renewable energy products? So I think we are in an environment where there is certainly risk in the near term. Then you have companies like Blackstone that has quite clearly broken its downtrend and is eating the lunch of the banking sector. So, certainly, you do have instances of clear outperformance amid the deteriorating environment in broad sectors. You definitely have the potential that energy will be among the best performing sectors over the next 6 months. And it is quite normal for the energy sector and the broader commodity sector to be among the better performers at the latter stages of a medium-term bull market. With China rolling over, I don't think that's going to be the case for the miners, but it's certainly potentially going to be the case for the energy companies in the near term. I do think, though, that we shouldn't be thinking about this in terms of a secular trend, but rather as a medium term, or I guess a 6 to 9 month potential boom in these sectors before we start to see the full lagged effect of rising interest rates, reducing the availability of liquidity, having an impact on consumer demand. So we're going to have, I think, certainly an interesting global environment where emerging markets, where Europe and Japan are going to be in a strong position to outperform over the lengthy medium term. When we think then about how ex-US has performed relative to the US, well, it's not outperforming today. So we've had the breakouts in Japan, we've had a breakout in Europe, and India's doing fine, but ex-US relative to the US is not performing. So the big lesson here is from a secular perspective. Major money is not going to move out of the USA until the Fang Man companies roll over relative to the wider market. When we think about the relative performance of the USA, it has been driven by those large companies, and it's probably not going to end until they stop performing. Now, we're in the region of the law of big numbers. And it's increasingly difficult to grow when you already have a market cap of 3 trillion. And obviously, there's a lot of enthusiasm around artificial intelligence. And I think artificial intelligence is going to be a tool that a lot of people are going to use over the next several years. Going back to my daughter, they had a talk just yesterday about the use of ChatGPT in writing college admittance essays. And obviously, that is something that's going to have a material effect on the way that the average student performs. And I think that is what we're going to see, is that drafting is going to be progressively easier, but then it's the added value and is going to be a differentiator in the future. And that is all has always been the case, but it will be progressively more important to be able to demonstrate added value over time. But that is where technology is heading. And it is something that will lead productivity gains out of any bear market. But ultimately, the performance of commodities, the performance of value versus growth, or the performance of ex-US versus the US is contingent on not those markets going up, but rather the outperformance of the mega cap companies rolling over. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.